On this week's show, in the news, a fight between two Texas statewide officials over the Alamo. Also hear about a boondoggle election recount out in West Texas, and about how one small town school admitting that they think they know better than parents how to raise kids. In our interview, we chat with Chris Edwards of the Cato Institute about Democrat presidential candidate plans to institute a wealth tax and how that failed in Europe. And we'll close with a commentary and a lesson on the real reason for the Christmas season. Welcome back to this week's episode of Texas Scorecard Radio. I, of course, am your host, Tony McDonald, coming to you from the 1836 studios here in Austin, Texas. You can always find us on the internet at www.texasscorecard.com. Managing editor for Texas Scorecard, Brandon Walton's here joining me with this week's top news. We've got a little bit of a tussle going on between a couple of Texas statewide elected officials over plans at the Alamo.
Very, very interesting situation. So as some folks may know, over the past few years, there's been this plan to reimagine the Alamo, spearheaded by the General Land Office, who right now, Land Commissioner is none other than George P. Bush.
Yeah, and so this plan, I mean, there's things in the plan that kind of everybody can love. There's a new museum, there's certain kind of investment in the site. Those things are good, but then there's a bunch of controversial elements and a lot of distrust because of some of the things that have been planned at different points in time in this reimagined proposal.
Right, as the project has moved forward, I think the biggest controversial part of this plan, at least as it is now, is to relocate the Alamo Cenotaph, which is, of course, a monument to the people, the freedom fighters, right, who died at that site. It was placed there, what, 100 years ago?
Yeah, it was on the centennial in 1936. Mm-hmm. So plan to move that to, you know, at one point move it way away. Now it's kind of next to the site. And that's a controversial proposal. But the current controversy is over this, you know, allegation that there's some kind of plan, and there's, it seemed to be some indication of support from this from the city of San Antonio, to put a statue of Santa Ana up at the site.
Yeah, and this story sort of made its way around that they were considering possibly, at least the city of San Antonio was considering putting a statue of Santa Ana there. You know, it's kind of backed up by some statements that San Antonio Mayor Ron Nuremberg made, where he said, well, we want to honor everybody on both sides who died at this site.
Everybody fighting for liberty at the site, except one side was fighting for tyranny and one side was fighting for liberty.
Now, no evidence points to Bush or the General Land Office, you know, ever having this proposal out there. And maybe that could have just been what George P. Bush said, but instead he went on a bit of a you know, nighttime Twitter tirade, in which by the way, nothing ever seems to come out of those. But he goes out and he accuses those who are pushing this story of being racist because he's Hispanic and says that anybody who criticizes those plans are racist. It actually caused Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick to come out and say, well, hold on a second. The people that are concerned about moving the cenotaph, that are concerned about with these plans, and 31 senators, by the way, who passed during this last legislative session a bill that would have made it more difficult to move the cenotaph, he says, they're not racist. This is offensive. This is inexcusable. And it's just inaccurate. So very, very interesting little fight right now between two of Texas's statewide leaders.
Well, something to keep an eye on is, will this plan move forward and these controversial elements move forward? And how will legislators like, you know, Lieutenant Governor Patrick and senators engage to fight back? I think we'll just have to keep tabs on that.
Yes, we will.
Next, let's turn and talk with Matt Stringer out in West Texas. Matt, you've had a bit of an election fiasco going on out there, a bond election for Midland ISD, initially showing as passing, then showing as failing, then showing as passing. Now there's ballots being found. It's a complete catastrophe. Tell us what's going on.
Let me tell you what, Tony, this has been an absolute roller coaster from the get-go. On election night, they had the bond as narrowly failing by a narrow margin. And then the elections office revealed a week later that it was actually failing by a narrow margin. So the pro bond PAC called for a recount of the election. They performed the recount, which flipped the election again to passing by 11 ballots. However, the recount found that there were over 800 ballots missing.
Yeah, and nonetheless, everybody moves forward. They certify this election with these missing ballots. Now the ballots have, we think, been found.
Absolutely, Tony. Midland residents were outraged that the Midland School Board moved forward certifying the election with knowing over 800 ballots were unaccounted for. The elections office claimed that they had provided all the ballots to the recount committee when clearly they hadn't. And then in the middle of the recount investigation, they emerged with a mystery box of ballots that they had to get a court order to open. And when they did, poof. 840 ballots, or 836.
Well, so which almost resolves the discrepancy. But so we have all of these ballots there. Now we're looking at it. There's been an election challenge. It's very interesting. The anti-bond group who have allegedly lost the election, they're working on an election challenge. But now the pro-bond PAC, who, you know, apparently at this point have won the election, are also challenging the results of the election because of these numbers.
It's absolutely amazing, Tony. You know, out of midst of all this chaos, there has been some sign of unity, and that both PACs are now pointing at the elections office, citing so many violations of the elections code and so many mishaps on their behalf that they are both joining together in filing petitions and separate petitions in district court to contest the election results.
Yeah, so everybody agrees the results are invalid. Now we'll see an election contest. I guess we'll just have to keep an eye on that to see how that develops in the courts and what the final result will be once these, you know, mystery box of ballots actually gets counted.
Absolutely, Tony. And I don't know if the mystery box will actually be tallied on whether or not they look at for or against, but right now we're waiting to see anytime this week the petition from the pro or the opposition bond PAC that's being done in conjunction with Direct Action Texas should be filed at any time.
Yeah, well, we'll keep an eye on it and see what happens there. The election could be thrown out. You could see a different result certified. We'll keep an eye on it. Thanks for your reporting, Matt.
Thanks, Tony.
Finally, let's go down to Montgomery County and talk with Reagan Reed. Big controversy going on there in Montgomery County, fairly rural county outside of Houston, in a small town there, Willis, Texas. About 5,000 people live in Willis. Yet nonetheless, this leftist agenda, the gender-bending agenda of the left, finding its way into the local schools. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, this is a story that hits especially close to home because I live in Willis. This is a community that votes about 85% Republican. And what that happened was they had a drag queen come in to the school and speak to the cosmetology department and teach the kids, you know, how to put on makeup as a man. And there's been a lot of outrage about it.
Yeah, tell us, the community obviously reacting to this. It's outrageous that this kind of agenda is finding its way, you know, not just into the public schools generally, but into a rural Republican public school like this, that you where you wouldn't necessarily expect these things to be happening.
Well, and the response to the district has been really disappointing. For example, we still don't know the actual identity of who this drag queen is, and the school is obstructing a lot of the records requests. And for example, I don't think there was even a background check done on this guy, which is what you're supposed to do if they're going to be at the school around the kids.
Yeah, so total breach of security and protocol. This story really getting a lot of attention because of what one teacher said about the parents and the reaction to it.
Yeah, well, when a bunch of the parents came to the school board meeting and protested about this, one of the teachers, Anthony Lane, took to social media with a statement and said that, you know, and I'm quoting, "The parents don't know best. We know better how to raise your kids than you do."
Yeah.
He said it's not the job of the school district to protect the, quote, bigoted, misguided views of the parents.
And this is the mentality there. Obviously, that drawing even more reaction from citizens to those kind of comments.
Yeah, well, when he said that, that turned this into a viral national news story. But, you know, the school district is digging in. The principal has defended the decision to allow the drag queen to come in, and they're digging in.
Yeah, I think the takeaway from this is, you know, these things are on the march, even in small town Texas, and, you know, school district, school board elections really matter right now.
Yeah, absolutely. These are the people that are educating the next generation, so your school board elections are probably the most important election you'll vote in.
Yeah, well, thanks for catching this. Thanks for your reporting on it, Reagan.
Absolutely.
Texas Scorecard Radio is a project of Empower Texans. At texasscorecard.com or empowertexans.com, you can find more news and daily updates from all around the Lone Star State. You can also find updates from Empower Texans and Texas Scorecard on Facebook and Twitter, and follow Empower Texans on Instagram. Texas Scorecard's News Digest goes out weekly via email and monthly in print. Subscribe online and find more information at empowertexans.com. Someone's always keeping score. We think it ought to be the taxpayers.
Well, many of the Democrats that are running for president talking about some radical ideas, including a massive wealth tax. And so I wanted to have somebody on to talk about that and explain what it would mean for Americans and Texans specifically. So it's great to have on this week Chris Edwards, Director of Tax Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. Thanks for joining us, Chris.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me. This is an important topic.
Yeah, so let's talk about this. I think the key leader on this is Elizabeth Warren, who's running for president. She's proposing a massive new wealth tax. Tell us what she's saying that we should adopt and how it would work, at least facially.
Well, America's never had a wealth tax of the type that Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are proposing. We have sort of annual wealth taxes in local property taxes. We also have the federal estate or death tax that happens only once, you know, when you die. But this idea of a wealth tax that over a dozen European countries used to have is an annual hit on wealth for wealthy people. So Elizabeth Warren has proposing tax rates of 2-6% on wealthy people, meaning that every year wealthy people would have to add up everything they own, their houses, all their financial assets, all their business ownership, everything they own. For farmers, all their farmland, all the value of it, and applying a tax rate like 2 to 6%. You can see how those tax rates don't sound that high, but you can see how devastating it is when you consider that, you know, an asset like a stock that creates an annual return of, say, 6%, Warren would be essentially grabbing the entire return that investment asset every year. So, you know, this is an extraordinarily heavy burden on assets. And the last point I'll make up front here is that, you know, the main assets of wealthy people are not things like, you know, jewelry and luxury yachts and the like. The vast majority of the assets of the wealthiest Americans, like Jeff Bezos of Amazon, is business assets, is their ownership in businesses, from car dealerships to internet companies to manufacturing companies. That is wealth. And Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders would hammer that wealth, and is that wealth that employs many millions of Americans. So this is a very destructive direction these politicians are taking.
Yeah, so if we're talking about a tax on wealth, you're looking not only at disincentivizing anything that has slow and steady wealth production. Why put your, you know, money into a stock ownership or something if it's going to grow at 6% and it's going to be taken? Well, then there's no point in doing that. So that's going to have a certain destructive effects. But then, of course, you have to cut a check to the government every year, I assume. So this would mean companies, properties, businesses would have to be liquidated in some way in order for the check to be cut.
That's absolutely right. This has, of course, always been a big problem with the estate or death tax, that if you have an ongoing business like a farm and the primary owner dies, he or she wants to pass it on to his sons or daughters, they have to come up with a lot of cash to pay the death tax at rates up to 40% and beyond. And so that really, you know, creates a lot of damage in an ongoing business. And it makes no sense. I mean, it seems to me at a basic level, we want wealthy people who own businesses to keep the business operating, to keep the business growing, to take their wealth and to reinvest it in the business. But the death tax, as well as an annual wealth tax, suggests the opposite. It creates incentive for wealthy people just to consume their wealth, to go out and buy the luxury yachts and the like, or to waste their money, essentially, rather than keeping it reinvested and growing in the economy. So these taxes create the opposite incentives for what, you know, we want as non-wealthy people, for wealthy people to do with their money.
Well, and of course, you know, most Americans are sitting out there, and these proposals at this time are for, you know, large sums of wealth, you know, over $50 million, over $1 billion, depending on the rates. And so you're thinking, well, maybe this isn't going to happen to me. But I'd like to address two things on that. First of all, if you think back to the income tax, that was how the income tax was sold, was, oh, well, this will only impact the very wealthy people. And then, of course, over time, once that tax is in place, it starts ratcheting down to, you know, encompass smaller and smaller estates and smaller incomes. But then beyond that, what impact on the economy would this have? That would impact, how would it impact somebody who, you know, okay, maybe they don't have to pay the tax, but they're still feeling the effects of the tax?
Well, on your first point, you're absolutely right. While Warren and Sanders claim that their tax would only hit the very wealthiest Americans, the reality, if you look at the dozen countries in Europe that used to have wealth taxes, France and Sweden and many others, they grabbed wealth at very low levels, down to $100,000 or so a year in wealth. So they were mass taxes on the middle class in Europe, not just taxes on the wealthy. And, you know, we have to remember that virtually all the European wealth taxes were repealed because they were so unpopular. Wealthy people found loopholes anyway, found ways to get around them. There was large exemptions. There was huge amounts of lobbying. The administrative costs were very high. If you think about, again, most wealth is in businesses, and private business wealth, you know, let's say you think of a privately owned manufacturing company or other sort of family businesses, they don't know, you know, what the value of their wealth is. And so they'd have all this additional bookkeeping burden to keep track of how much, to estimate how much their business was worth. So in European countries, you know, found that it just wasn't worth it. They hardly raised any money. They were usually complex and damaging, and so they repealed them. So, you know, this is a failed idea, and even, you know, the left of center, you know, governments in Europe and places like France repealed these taxes. So it's a really a radical idea, and it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, so interesting points that can be taken from that European experiment of failure with their wealth taxes. One of the things you mentioned was the various carve-outs that end up happening. Obviously, the wealthy people are the ones who are able to hire lobbyists to go and advocate for a carve-out for their particular interest, and so you suddenly have
exactly right. I mean, one of the reasons why the European wealth taxes so disastrous and complex is that as soon as they were put in place, of course, all the wealthy people started immediately lobbying and demanding exemptions. So they had dimensions for, you know, pensions and farmland and many other things. Many countries in Europe had exemptions for artwork. France, not surprisingly, had an exemption for large wine collections, believe it or not. So the wealthy got their loopholes. And if you think about the United States, if an Elizabeth Warren was actually elected president and this sort of tax sort of proposal started working its way through Congress, Obviously, folks like the farmers would demand exemptions for farmland, and the farm lobby is, of course, very powerful. So farmland would be exempted.
Yeah,
the,
so she would want to run. She would want to run for re-election.
Wealthy people like Jeff Bezos would start buying up all the farmland in America, inflating and distorting the agricultural economies in places like Kansas and Iowa. So it would be a disastrous tax for United States.
Yeah, she would want to run for re-election in Iowa, of course. And so she would have to appeal to that base in Iowa. So you would, of course, see the farms carved out of this proposal. And so, but what would that mean? It would mean that Jeff Bezos would have every incentive to go in and just buy up all the farmland he could as a store of wealth.
That's right.
That's amazing.
There are many other powerful lobbies in Washington. I'll give you another example of this. State and local government bonds that fund local infrastructure like schools and highways, they're exempted from the federal income tax. Obviously, those bonds would be exempted under any wealth tax because of the power of the 50 governors coming and lobbying Washington. So there would be another exempt asset. And this would go on over time. More and more assets would be exempted, which would create more unfairness and an unlevel playing field. And that would generate even more lobbying in Washington. It's really the irony here, of course, is that Warren and Saunders claim to they denounce the lobbying by wealthy people in Washington. And as you say, this would increase the lobbying by wealthy people in Washington and create more unfairness.
Yeah, it seems to me that it's almost an irony that people who complain about wealth and wealthy people and engage in kind of this jealousy over wealth would be then increasing the participation. Obviously, folks who were being hit by this tax would have every incentive to be involved actively, vociferously, to defend their personal interests in government. And so
absolutely.
You would see
one of the other things that really it drives me crazy about this whole debate is Warren and Sanders sort of frame it like every wealthy person in America is corrupt and we need to hammer them and punish them with a wealth tax. Of course, I agree with them. Sometimes they talk about cronyism, and I agree with them that we should end special carve-outs and handouts for wealthy people. But the truth is, the vast majority of wealth in America, and you can look at the lists of the wealthiest Americans, they are people like Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos and Steve Jobs and many other entrepreneurs who have built great companies that have done enormously beneficial things for the U.S. economy, creating new products and cutting prices and adding competition. That's what, America's wealth is mainly entrepreneurial wealth. And it makes absolutely no sense. If you want to get at the cronyism, don't impose a tax on every wealthy person. Go after the cronyism directly and cut it out.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting you mentioned some of these most wealthy people. We'll occasionally see a news story where the list has been reshuffled because of an active day in the stock market. Businesses rise and fall. And it makes me look at this and go, well, how in the world would we even know how much wealth one of these people has? They literally
exactly.
change positions day to day.
Absolutely. Think, for example, about Uber, a company that is losing massive amounts of money. It has a high stock market valuation, but it's only sort of potential or theoretical wealth. Uber may not be able to find a business model where they actually make profits, and then the stock price will collapse. So what does that mean for a wealth tax? Are we going to tax the owners of Uber at this currently high, sort of bubble valuation in their stock? And how fair is that, given that next year the price may collapse? And they certainly don't have the cash to pay.
they don't have any revenue.
They're not generating positive cash flow from their company. So, the idea of a wealth tax just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. Well, it's interesting. Certainly, we have a lot of experience with this, seeing what Europe has done, and certainly it would be a disaster here. You've got a good report up at Cato, at the Cato Institute about this proposal. Tell folks who are listening at home, and we're running out of time, tell folks who are listening at home, how can they connect with you? How can they learn more about this if they want to know more about how these proposals would be a disaster?
if you just Google Chris Edwards, you'll find my page at the Cato Institute, and I have two very good reports on these issues. One is on the wealth taxation directly and the European experience, and another study I recently published is on the general topic of exploring wealth inequality, what it means, and is it good or is it bad, and is it rising, is it falling? So those two detailed wealth analyses are under my name, Chris Edwards at the Cato Institute.
Great. Well, appreciate you coming on and shedding a little light on this, and thanks for the work you do.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Kerry Cheshire, Vice President of Texans for Fiscal Responsibility. The 2020 election will be here before we know it, and with every election comes candidates that need to be vetted and tested before we can entrust them with our vote. At TFR, we take that vetting process seriously. Any candidate seeking our endorsement must first fill out a comprehensive questionnaire, then sit for an interview with our staff. We then seek input from each candidate's would-be constituents before making a decision. To find out more about our endorsement process and view which candidates have made the cut, visit empowertexans.com/endorsements.
Well, it's Christmas time, and we certainly find ourselves singing O Little Town of Bethlehem. In this week's Texas Scorecard Radio commentary, Empower Texans CEO Michael Quinn Sullivan talks about how Bethlehem, even today, is less than an idyllic setting, but that really underscores the reason for the season.
I'm Michael Quinn Sullivan with this week's Texas Scorecard Radio commentary. Can I admit something to you? Bethlehem has been my least favorite place to visit in Israel. It's dirty and run by the Palestinian Authority. It just doesn't feel safe. Standing in Bethlehem the first time, I couldn't help but think there had to be 100 better places for the Messiah to have been born. And as a father, I can't help but feel Joseph had similar feelings that night so long ago, despite the angelic assurances he had received months earlier. His pregnant young bride was ready to pop. They were far from home in a manger cut into the side of a hill. With one glance, Joseph knew his son's first cradle would be a rocky trough. Braying donkeys would announce the birth. Yeehaw! While perhaps a little town, though, Bethlehem was hardly inconsequential. It's mentioned more than 50 times in the Bible, mostly in the Old Testament. Everyone who cared to know knew it was where the Messiah was prophesied to enter the world. But in a manger? We've sanitized the scene. There are no animal droppings, no flies, no dirt, no grime. At Christmas, we focus on idyllic images of a babe in swaddling clothes. Not a bloodbath in the streets of Bethlehem, ordered by a jealous king clinging to power. We think of a young mother receiving gifts from three wise men. Not that baby growing up to be horribly murdered on a cross. We sanitize his arrival to make ourselves feel better. After all, consumermus cannot be bothered by the recognition of our deep-rooted sin. In the moral economy of the Holy God, Jesus came not as he deserved, but as we needed him. He was born next to excrement because so are our attempted good works in the eyes of God, to borrow from the Apostle Paul. Jesus had to arrive in the dingy streets of the overcrowded Bethlehem. He had to be a stranger in a strange land. He had to walk on rough road. He had to stand in for you, for me, for those who would believe in him. For God and sinners to be reconciled, Jesus had to live sinlessly through the worst of experiences so he could be the perfect sacrifice. Jesus didn't deserve to be born in Bethlehem any more than we deserve his mercy. Wishing you a very Merry Christmas, I'm Michael Quinn Sullivan with a Texas Scorecard Radio commentary.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the show. If you enjoy the Texas Scorecard Radio podcast, you can give me and the team here a little bit of a Christmas present. If you go on and leave a 5-star review on your favorite podcasting platform, just go on there and hit the 5 stars and leave a few notes on why you like the program. That helps raise the visibility of the program for other listeners to find us and learn the news that they need to know to be involved in Lone Star State. Beyond that, we'll be taking a week off for Christmas. So I have a couple archive interviews. I think you will enjoy those if you do tune in, and then be back with a new program to start the new year. I wish each of you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Thanks for listening.
Texas Scorecard Radio is brought to you each week as a public service from the Empower Texans Foundation and in partnership with the Lincoln Institute and this station. You can download podcasts from each program and learn more at empowertexans.com.